Hello, I'm Rob Attar, and this is the fourth History Extra podcast for August 2012. Coming up in this week's episode, we have...
Online geospatial mapping is still using Ptolemy, which I think gives you a sense of how remarkable it is.
That was Jerry Broughton on the father of geography.
Nervous, windy spasms. Yeah.
And that was David Musgrove being surprised by a Victorian recipe book. This podcast is brought to you by the team behind BBC History Magazine, which is Britain's best-selling history magazine. You can find it in all good newsagents and on subscription. There are more details of our latest issue and subscription deals on our website, which is historyextra.com. And we are now available in a number of digital formats. You can purchase our Kindle edition direct from the Amazon website, and our iPad edition is available from the Apple newsstand. You can find out more details of all of this on our website. Of course, we're on social media as well. You can keep up to date with us and get in touch at facebook.com/historyextra and twitter.com/historyextra. In our September issue, historian Jerry Broughton examines the work of Ptolemy, a 2nd century AD geographer who worked in Alexandria in Egypt. Ptolemy was the author of Geography, which became the foundation text for map-making for centuries afterwards. So great, in fact, was Ptolemy's legacy that it influenced the explorations of Columbus and can even be seen in Google Earth. I paid a visit to see Jerry a few weeks ago to get the full story. What do we know about Ptolemy himself as a person?
What's really interesting is that we know virtually nothing about Ptolemy. So there are much later Greek records talking about him, but from his actual life we know virtually nothing. And this is what's really interesting, because he's known as the father of modern geography, but all we know is that he lived around 150 AD. He lived in Alexandria. He presumably had some connection with the Alexandria Library, which is where he developed his research that led to the production of the geography around the same time, 150 AD. But beyond that, we know virtually nothing. We assume that he was probably Egyptian in the sense that we would understand it, but his name would indicate a connection to the Roman Hellenic tradition. So he's possibly Greek. He's certainly coming out of a Greek tradition. So we tend to see him as really a Greek geographer working in Alexandria. But that's really all we know, which is sort of interesting, because it just gives us very, very little to go on in terms of who he was, what his motivation was for mapping, why he created the geography. All we have is that text itself. And that in itself tells us very little, because it's really a very disinterested scientific account really of how you draw up a map and what the world looks like circa 150 AD.
And so you could briefly summarise what exactly are the contents of the geography, what's in it, if someone were to pick it up?
The geography, you can see in modern translations, is basically a series of books which are like a toolkit. It's a toolkit of how to make a map of the world. So it's a series of chapters which are drawing on Euclidean geometry, are drawing on the knowledge of the known world at the time of 150 AD, which is often called by historians of geography the oikoumene. Oikoumene means the living space. It's the Mediterranean world. And what the book does is start by defining geography. It says what geography is. Geography is a description of the world and all the parts within it. And then it gives you examples of how you might draw a map of the world. And Ptolemy is very interesting, because he says, I understand that the world is spherical. You cannot therefore square the circle. You cannot map the world on a flat surface, on a rectangle, because it's a globe. You have to make compromises and you have to make distortions. So what the book does is it offers two methods for drawing the world. So there's the first projection and the second projection. And that's quite detailed. It's literally, it says, you know, you take a piece of paper, you get a pen, you shape the world like this, and it tells you how to do it very precisely. What the second half of the book does is give you coordinates for about 8,000 locations, places in the known world, as it was known to the Greeks in 150 AD, and the Romans, of course. So it's a sort of like a game of battleships. It gives you all the coordinates, and it then says, you can go away and you can draw a map according to your own principles, whatever you want to do. So it's extraordinary, really. It's not very prescriptive. It just says, these are the problems. This is how you draw a map. These are the coordinates of the world as we know it. And I think that's one of the reasons that it's so successful, because it basically says, choose your method of mapping, and here are the coordinates, but the world is probably larger than this, so you can find new places, so your map can infinitely grow. And I think that's why it was so successful, and for thousands of years, of course, carried on being so influential.
Did people at the time then draw maps, do we know, based on this book? Did it have any practical application?
Not really, because we know that there's two traditions. What Ptolemy does is he sort of summarizes a Greek, very philosophical tradition of geography and a Roman tradition, which is much more about imperial administration. So what you have throughout the Greek tradition is different ways of mapping the world. And there are all kinds of different assessments of how you draw, how you use a globe, how you project it onto a rectangle. And that goes right back to Plato and Aristotle and before. All with a notion, of course, of the Earth as being spherical. They're very sophisticated in their understanding of it. They even have a very accurate measurement of the circumference of the Earth. So Ptolemy's drawing on that tradition, but he's also drawing on a Roman tradition, which is much more about mapping roads, mapping imperial territory, and then the globe for the Romans is much more a sort of symbolic image. You know, it stands in Rome as an image of imperium. So he's sort of bringing the two together. But what's interesting is that the book really gets lost. It isn't really taken up after Ptolemy's death. And interestingly, it goes into the Arabic world. And the Arabs are particularly interested in Ptolemy for astronomical reasons, because he's also writing books about astronomy. But they're also interested to some extent in how he maps. But the book completely disappears. You know, it's part of that sort of Dark Ages argument, which to some extent is true here, because basically the book is written in 150 AD, it almost completely disappears from sight until it's rediscovered in the late Byzantine Empire in the 12th and 13th century. So there's really 1,000 years where it just goes underground. And it really resurfaces in the Arabic world. And one of the interesting elements of the book is that it tells a story about how both East and West take different routes in terms of how they map. So the Islamic tradition ends up taking up Ptolemy from the 8th, 9th century. And then the Byzantines, and then of course the European Renaissance, takes up Ptolemy in a slightly different way from the 12th, 13th, 14th centuries.
What about his book was new? Was it a really revolutionary book when it was written?
I don't think it is. I think this is what's really interesting about it. It's a sort of summation of universal knowledge at that time. Because 150 AD seems quite early, but actually it's very late in the tradition of the Alexandria Library. The Alexandria Library is seriously in decline. It's been pillaged, it's been burnt. It's at the end of that great flowering of Hellenic civilization. So I think what is going on is that Ptolemy comes along and almost summarizes everything. It's the summation of a culture's perception of geography. So in a way, it's not terribly radical. He completely underestimates the size of the Earth. There are more recent Greek traditions which give him a much more accurate take, but he ignores them. He gets it all wrong. So in many ways, it's not very new and it's not very accurate. But what it does is it just gives you the tools as to how you may map the world, and that's what people take forward for the next over 1,000 years.
So is its importance more the fact that it was rediscovered around the Renaissance time? Is that why it's so important now?
Yeah, because the great thing about Ptolemy is that we don't even know if he drew any maps. This is one of the great elements, that it's a text, it's a written text. The descriptions describe drawing maps, but no maps survive until the late 12th, early 13th century. The first world maps in Ptolemy are Byzantine copies of over 1,000 years later. So this is really fascinating because historians of cartography still argue, did Ptolemy draw maps or not? And I think he probably didn't. I think in a weird way, it's almost, it's a digital way of describing geography. It's about numbers. That's what he gives you. He gives you numbers, coordinates, geometry, how you draw something. And I think that's why it endures, because people can then use it as I say, a kind of toolkit. So when the Portuguese or the Italians are starting to engage in seaborne discoveries and exploration from the 15th century, they're going to Ptolemy because Ptolemy gives them a method for how they might map. They're not interested in whether Ptolemy's geography of the world is right or wrong. They're interested in using that as a template, as a model for how they may map. And that's what they do, and that's why they're so fascinated by producing new editions of Ptolemy, because actually what they're doing is just using him as a template, and the maps they produce have very little in common with the Greek world as Ptolemy describes it, because they're doing maps of the Americas, they're doing maps of the Far East, which Ptolemy didn't know anything about, but it's a model that he gives them, which is very useful for a certain period of time.
And is that still being used now, his principles? When did they stop being used?
Well, the principles haven't really stopped at all. I mean, he gives you the basic elements of how you draw a map using latitude and longitude. He gives you a basic understanding of how you see the Earth from space and how you map a world onto a flat rectangle. Ptolemy really gives you that. So in a sense, it's the foundational principles of all map making. So it's really only in the 16th century that people start to say, people like McKay to say, Ptolemy's vision of what the world looks like is wrong or it's limited. And it's only from the 16th century that those ideas of Ptolemy's world go into decline and it just becomes an element of historical curiosity. But the basic foundational principles endure right through. The projection that Google Earth uses on its homepage is called a perspective projection, which is how you see the Earth from space. Ptolemy gives a description of that projection. He calls it his third projection in the geography in 150 AD. So online geospatial mapping is still using Ptolemy, which I think gives you a sense of how remarkable it is. It's not a revolutionary book, but it is a remarkable book.
In fact, for your book, you spoke to people at Google Earth. Did they mention Ptolemy at all?
No, they didn't. I mean, it's really interesting because, of course, a lot of the people who work now in online mapping are not trained in geography. They are what they call geospatial engineers. They're basically working in computer software. So it's quite interesting that they sort of understand the historical tradition within which they're working, Ptolemy, Mercator, or Tellius, and so on. But really what they're interested in is warping and messing around with software, because it's really visual data. You know, Google Earth is not a map. It's a photoreal image. I mean, you can switch. If you're on Google, you can switch between Google Earth and Google Maps. But they are really much more interested in this as computer code. But I still think that's really what Ptolemy's offering right back in the geography. He's giving you a form of rudimentary code in terms of numbers, latitude, longitude, how you actually draw a projection. And that's really what those computer engineers at places like Google are still doing. So I don't think they really get the fact that they're part of a much longer history. Although, of course, calling Google Earth, Google Earth, is quite a deliberate geographical act. You know, it's interesting that it's not called Google World, because it's a world map. But by using Earth, they're again returning to that idea of the soil, you know, that there's something environmental and slightly touchy-feely about it. And of course, Ptolemy defines geography as geography. Geo is from the Greek idea of the goddess of the earth, Gaia, actually. And graphos is, of course, the graphic, to write, to draw, geography. And Google Earth is doing something quite similar. You know, it's saying it's Google Earth. So it has a certain argument about environmentalism. a common earth, a whole earth, you know, a fragile earth. And so I think they're drawing on those very distinctive ways of describing our common geography, which is around earth. It's not around the idea of world or even globe. You know, it could be Google Globe. It's a globe, actually, that they show us. But they're using that term earth very deliberately, and that has a very long cartographic lineage which goes right back to Ptolemy.
So do you think if Ptolemy had somehow survived to this day and aged 2000, would he recognise the things in Google Earth? Would he not find it such a leap then?
He'd absolutely see it, because what he describes is how you imaginatively detach yourself from the earth and you look down on it from a godlike perspective. And that's one of the most significant things about what all world maps do. They take a godlike perspective. And of course, Google Earth is the first, if you want to call it a map, it's certainly the first geographical application which actually is using data which is taken from that godlike perspective. It's satellite data which is taken above the Earth. But I think Ptolemy would be fascinated by it, because it finally gives him the perspective that he's always imagined, literally imagined. You know, all map makers before the 1970s have to imagine. It's an imaginative act to detach themselves from the Earth and look down on it as a small blue marble. And of course, Google Earth now gives you that resource. So I think Ptolemy would be fascinated by it. I don't know what he'd think about the commercial dimensions of it, but he'd certainly get the fact that this is an extraordinary summation, really, of a much longer history of technological innovation in terms of how we map the Earth.
And so is Ptolemy really the sort of key player in geography in this period?
Absolutely. I mean, as I say, it's weird because there's not a lot of historical chatter about him for many hundreds of years. There are fragments, but no, he's not as important as many of the much earlier Greek figures that are known around this period. He does go into a sort of twilight world, but certainly from the late 14th, early 15th century, by then he's the figure, and he remains so really for another 200 years. Until, interestingly, of course, the Copernican Revolution, because, of course, what Ptolemy is talking about is a geocentric universe. The Earth is at the centre of everything. And really, it's with Copernicus in 1543 on the revolution of the spheres, which changes all that and says, you know, the sun is at the centre of the solar system, the Earth revolves around the sun. And that, of course, takes a long time to work through into the common consciousness. And I have a chapter on Blau's Atlas Major, which is mid-17th century. And that first enshrines a Copernican view of the universe. So it shows a world map with the idea that we are no longer at the center of the universe. And from that point on, I think that whole Ptolemaic world picture certainly is definitively over, because it does, of course, put the world at the center of everything from a Greek perspective. And that's one that the Catholic Church likes the idea of. But by the 17th century, that's very much over.
So he had a good run. So for 1,500 years, he was the leading light in the field.
He had a great run. And I mean, still, yeah, anybody who has to talk about either the history of geography or the history of cartography, the foundational text is Ptolemy's Geography. Everybody has to account for it. But it's very interesting because it's created by somebody that we know virtually nothing about, and it contains no maps from its earliest manifestations. So I think I think it's interesting because classicists, I still think, have a lot of work to do to try and find out more about what was really happening at that moment. So I don't think it's over. We still need to know a lot more about both what drove Ptolemy and actually still how the work re-emerged. And there's still interesting work being done on Arabic and Islamic mapping and how they perceived Ptolemy. So I think the story is by no means over. But yeah, he's absolutely foundational to everything around the story of maps and the story of geography.
And isn't he quite important in exploration as well? Didn't some of the explorers take him with them on their voyages?
Absolutely, because what's interesting is that both Columbus in 1492 and Magellan in his 1519 circumnavigation of the Earth used Ptolemy's coordinates. And Ptolemy's coordinates are wrong. But in their wrongness, they and in their error, they believe that going west to get to the east, which drives both Columbus and Magellan. You know, Magellan's idea is that you sail via the tip of South America to get to the spice-producing islands of the Indonesian archipelago. So his idea is going via the Cape is much longer, according to Ptolemy. He's using Ptolemy's coordinates. And he thinks, using Ptolemy, that if you go west, you're going to get to the east quicker. And Columbus, of course, believes that as well, because he's, of course, trying to get to Japan and China. He doesn't think that America's in the way. So he uses Ptolemy, just as Magellan does, and that's what drives both of them to go west. So without Ptolemy's mistakes, we wouldn't have had Columbus and certainly Magellan's voyage. And of course, for Magellan, it's fatal, because that mistake leads him to sail right across most of the Pacific Ocean. And of course, he dies in the Philippines in a skirmish that he gets involved in with locals. And there's no doubt, I think, that if both men had a more accurate assessment of the circumference of the Earth, they wouldn't have gone. But because they have this inaccurate circumference based on Ptolemy, they decide that this is a viable voyage, and certainly Magellan's isn't viable. And certainly for Magellan, it's fatal. So he's absolutely central. So all that history of discovery from the mid-15th right through to the late 16th century is endlessly using Ptolemy, because what everybody knows that bits of Ptolemy are wrong. They've no doubt that Ptolemy is wrong in a lot of what he says. Of course he is, because he has no conception of the Americas. But what they want is a template, a model within which they can start changing things. They can say, okay, this is our template according to Ptolemy, and okay, America's new, and this is new, and oh, actually, you know, Southeast Asia is completely new. But they can start to try and test and assess how they reshape a map of the world, and gradually the Ptolemaic picture starts to morph and change. But that's all they've got. So that's the model that they begin with. And that's why it takes so long gradually for them to disassociate themselves from Ptolemy, because it's a useful, it's like a big chessboard. It's a good way of roughly getting a sense of what your world looks like. And of course, as with all these things, as with Galen and all these great Aristotle, the great classical authorities, people are very reluctant to give up on them. So there's a lot of examples of when people discover places in South America. Back in Europe, people say, it can't be true because Ptolemy says it can't be true. So there's still a lot of that, that people like Columbus, like Magellan, a lot of the early map makers are playing an interesting game where they're having to say, well, Ptolemy didn't seem to believe that Brazil existed, but he's a bit vague. And now, well, yeah, maybe we can account for Brazil through Ptolemy, because, of course, what they want is the classical authority to legitimate the new discoveries, because then people will believe them. So it's a weird cat and mouse game that's played with, you know, what they believe Ptolemy might have said and might have thought, and using that, using Ptolemy as a sort of crutch to convince people, because otherwise people would just say, well, the classic authors don't say anything about this place, so we don't believe that it can be true. Because, of course, the Renaissance is a period of the rebirth of classical learning, which is what you take as your absolute authority on everything. And it takes a long time, as it does with people like Aristotle, for those beliefs to shift and to people to truly challenge them and prove them to be wrong.
That was Jerry Broughton, Professor of Renaissance Studies at Queen Mary, University of London. Jerry is the author of A History of the World in 12 Maps, which will be published by Allen Lane next month. And do also look out for his piece on Ptolemy in the September issue of BBC History magazine, which is available now in the UK and internationally on the Kindle and the iPad. Before the next interview, I'd like to remind you about a couple of lectures we're putting on at the British Academy in London over the next couple of months. On Thursday the 20th of September, Tracy Borman and Mark Morris will be discussing the Norman Conquest. And then on Thursday the 18th of October, Lawrence Rees and Ashley Jackson will be considering two Second World War leaders, Hitler and Churchill. On both occasions, you'll have the chance to meet the distinguished speakers afterwards and purchase signed copies of their books. Tickets are still available for both talks. Go to historyextra.com/lectures for more details and to buy tickets. And if you're a subscriber to the magazine, you'll save £5 on the ticket price. BBC History Magazine's publisher, David Musgrove, visited the Borthwick Institute at the University of York recently and met up with two trainee archivists there, Amy Croker and Zoe Harrigan, who've been researching some curious 18th and 19th century recipe books in the papers of the Halifax collection there. David leafed through the books with Amy and Zoe, but first he asked Amy to introduce the archive.
So we're looking at these records which are related to consumption of food and preparation of food from the 17th to the 19th century, and they're all from the Halifax archive, and that relates to, broadly speaking, the Wood family, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. When people think of the Wood family, they might most instantly think of E.F.L. Wood, who was actually acted as Foreign Secretary during the Second World War in Neville Chamberlain and Churchill's government, and his great-grandfather actually owned the recipes, most of the recipes that we see here today, or were produced or compiled by his wife anyway. Mary Wood's recipe book is particularly interesting, and she was the wife of Charles Wood, and also the daughter of Earl Grey, the famous Prime Minister who lent his name to the bergamot-flavoured tea. So this is a family of quite some weight in Yorkshire. Charles himself actually served as Chancellor of the Exchequer in John Russell's government. So they were a family of quite strong political background and quite some weight in the government.
So a notable Yorkshire family with strong political connections. And do we know where they were resident?
They had a number of residences. Temple Newson was one in near Leeds, Hickleton Hall in Doncaster, and also Garraby as well.
OK, and their archive has been deposited here at the Borthwick Institute?
Yes.
Shall we start at the beginning then with this earlier recipe book then? So what's this from, and what sort of things have you found in it? It's one of these documents where, oh no, it's not, the writing is fairly legible actually, isn't it? What's the date of this then, were you saying?
We haven't got an exact date on this, but we think it dates from the 17th or 18th century. So probably a collection of recipes throughout, handed down perhaps, and from friends and family. This one's interesting because it has interesting recipes like to collar a calf's head.
Right.
And we have another evidence of the sharing of recipes between friends and family. So here's obviously a letter from Mrs. Blytheman. The recipe's been received in a letter to preserve walnuts, and then has obviously been kept and copied down later neatly into the book. So perhaps the recipe was tried and tested and approved, and they thought this is good enough to go into our book now. And
there's
some interesting creams here that you might not hear of now, like Tough Taffety cream, which is quite a quaint.
What's that?
Tough Taffety cream. Okay. And she's written below it approved, so she's obviously tried it and thought it was a good recipe.
What do you have to do? Take a quart of thick cream, the whites of
six or seven eggs. Beat the whites with a little rose water, all to froth with a whisk. Take it off, put it in the cream, then set it on the fire and let it boil, stirring continuously.
Very Jamie Oliver, isn't it?
And you can see some, not a lot, but some foreign influences in this book, because it still is quite relatively early recipe book. So here we have French dumplings showing some early French influences. Yep. And then at the back we have sort of obviously a rough sketch out of what a meal might have consisted of. So first course and the second course.
Yeah.
With chicken puddings. And then a turkey in the second remove.
Got some wildfowl and some lobsters there. And
mince pies. A shoulder of mutton.
Right. That's not a light meal, is it?
And what they would have done is they wouldn't have been expected to eat everything. Everything would have been presented. As they walk into the room, all the food will have been laid out for the first course. And then the guests will have sat down and they will have just taken bits of whatever they fancied. They wouldn't have been expected to just consume everything. It wasn't a case of all you can eat. It was a case of providing something to suit everyone's taste. Mm.
Sure. So is there any sort of preface to this book? What does it start with? Does it just start with a recipe? Or
it just leaps straight into the recipes.
Let's have a look at the start of it.
So it seems like some of the pages are actually missing.
Yeah.
It begins on page 5 and They've obviously been ripped out, but it could well have just been recipes from the start, but the favourite ones were perhaps ripped out and given to friends or given to members of the family.
Yeah. It's clearly been quite well used, hasn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Actually could do with some conservation work.
It's very fragile, yeah.
So is this the oldest recipe book that you've discovered in the collection?
Yes, it is, yes. Yeah.
And do you have any idea about how common these sort of books might have been more broadly? Have you been able to look beyond just this
market? I think they would be quite common. I think it was sort of obviously cookery books, printed cookery books, were quite popular in the Victorian as well as pre that time. And I think the lady of the house would have had the book and copied out the recipes that she specifically wanted, and then that would have gone to the staff, the housekeeper and such. So I would imagine a lot of houses would have had their own handwritten recipe books in order to refer to.
Okay. Shall we move on in time a bit then? So we've got some more books here. What are these? Where do they date from?
We've got Lady Anne Wood's here. Receipts of Anne Wood.
Okay. So what period
so
would this be?
So that is eight...
That would have been late 18th century, sorry.
Okay. Yeah. And the interesting thing about this one is that it's predominantly medicinal.
Right.
So they're sort of homemade remedies for things like gout and rheumatism and asthma and things like that. And the sort of funny thing about them is that they often contain the same kind of spices as the food recipes. So there's not a lot in them aside from the fact that they have things like sulfur or lead or mercury, laudanum, yeah. So there's kind of a toxic element to it. So some of them are very sort of broad. So we've got Dr. Johnson's Elixir of Health.
Right.
And that's just, what have we got? Senna, coriander, caraway, juniper berries,
a bit of saffron, some treacle maybe.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds helpful.
A spot of gin as well. Yeah. Takes 10 days to work.
And then you'll be healthy.
And then you'll be just healthy.
Right.
So it's very sort of non-specific. And then there are some that are, there's nervous windy spasms here.
Nervous windy spasms?
Yeah. Not entirely sure what that means, but violent discharges. And we assume that these would be made much in the same way as the food. But it would be a book that sat in the... perhaps in her possession rather than in the kitchen, but it was all the same sorts of ingredients. So there's purgative gingerbread.
That sounds delightful.
Yeah. It's not quite what you want your gingerbread to do. Pecoric elixir. What else have we got? Oh, that's right. Application for all inwards pains and spasms. Very efficacious and safe. Contains laudanum.
Right.
So, probably relaxing you a bit. So, it just seemed quite interesting that there were so many medicinal recipes here. If you swallow a pin, that's how to.
What should you do if you swallow a pin? Take four
grams of emetic tartar. Swallow the whites of 6 raw eggs before the emetic tartar takes effect. The eggs will have formed an envelope around the pin and be thrown up.
Remarkable.
Yeah, apparently. We've not tried it.
No. Oh.
So
I wonder how common pin swallowing was.
Well, yeah. Who knows?
So it's a medicinal recipe book, and then behind it is this a more traditional recipe book?
Yeah, these are, I think there are some medicinal recipes towards the end, but they're mostly food, and they're from Mary Wood, so that would be 1870, I think this book dates
right at.
And it's a very nice book, really, isn't it?
It's actually approved by CW there, so presuming that's Charles W, her husband. So
right.
She's obviously tried that and said, oh, I like that. Tell the housekeeper to make a note of it.
Yeah.
And
what is that? Prime beef for hanging.
Right,
okay. So that's got the nod of approval, right?
Yeah, and it's also a recipe. I mean, hanging beef is quite common still today, but it's another recipe that takes a very long time to work. There are some recipes within here that you have to stir them every hour for 3 days, and you know, it's very much a full time.
There's a lot of emphasis then on the time and effort that it took to prepare things, whereas now there's much more. Everyone wants things now and instantly, and dawn of convenience food. It sits in quite stark contrast to the previous take on how food should be eaten and how it should be prepared.
And there's, we're looking at a page here which has got Scotch eggs on it, which is obviously something we have today, but on the previous page there was black Smyrna raisin wine, I noticed. So we've got some more traditional and some less traditional.
Yeah, you start to see more foreign influence in this one particularly, a lot more in the way of French recipes, definitely, which kind of fits in with the reading we've done that says that, you know, French chefs became very, very popular in courtly kitchens, and people tried to emulate these sorts of recipes. So you've got the omelette, and I think there's an omelette sucre in there somewhere. And we've got
tomato ketchup is also an interesting addition, because tomatoes were, up until the sort of late 19th century, were sort of regarded with a bit of caution, and some people saw them as a violent aphrodisiac.
Right.
And the colour would set people on edge a bit, and they thought tomatoes might be dangerous. So to have a tomato ketchup recipe is probably quite unusual at this time, because tomatoes weren't as readily available then.
Okay.
I suppose being quite a family of quite high class, they will have brought a lot of influences from abroad in their travels. This is the time of the Grand Tour, where, you know, young men of means would go abroad and travel around Europe, and obviously no doubt bring things back that they particularly enjoyed, mention them to their cooks or housekeepers, and ask them to recreate the dishes that they'd sampled on their travels.
And we've got receipts from 1850s time, which are a lot of the products are Italian, so there's parmesan and vermicelli and things like that, so there's obviously a very sophisticated taste for that time, I think.
There's an increasing move towards as well buying more things readily made. As the 19th century progresses, with improvements in transport and the improvements in the preservation of food, a lot more goods are bought from shops rather than grown in the kitchen gardens, and so you find that in our inventories that people have bought things like Italian paste and sort of stock started to be produced as well, so people didn't have to boil their own meats for hours to make their own.
So You've been studying these documents. You've seen some quite interesting things, some faintly amusing things, but some interesting findings as well. So, what sort of learnings are you getting here about the consumption and preparation of food in the 17th through to the 19th centuries? Would you say?
I think we have noticed in our books that there's not a great emphasis on the cooking of meat, but there is a bigger emphasis on confectionery and sweet foods and puddings, and that could partly be to do with the fact that they were considered maybe more difficult to make, and so writing down the method of making them was considered more important. But it could also be to do with the fact that the English were known for their love of sweet foods and for confectionery, and famous for their puddings, and they actually consumed a lot more sugar during this period than the French. So it shows, although it shows, we can see French influences, we can also see quite a strong tradition of English cooking as well in the puddings and the emphasis on the sweet foods.
So how far are you seeing the French influence? When do you see it coming through? I mean, you know, famously you've got that French chef, Alexis Soyer, who was probably the most famous chef who came over here and started introducing French ideas. When do you start to see, you know, an inkling of a continental influence coming through, Jane?
Well, I think in that the earlier textbook we looked at, recipe book we looked at, which was dated 17th or 18th century thing, as we said previously, there isn't a great evidence of French influence there. But I think when you move to Mary Wood's recipe book, which was then moving into the 1800s, you do notice more of a French influence. Not massive, but certain foods like soup à la reine are introduced, and omelette sucre, and which aren't as much in evidence as in the earlier book. And we also notice in these as well a heavy Italian influence in the sort of foods that they bought. The receipts show macaroni, Italian paste, parmesan. So this family seemed to have quite an inclination towards Italian eating, more, perhaps more so than French.
Okay, so you're seeing a European influence, French and Italian. Yeah. Perhaps, as you said before, from the experience of the Grand Tour, but not so much from the Empire, perhaps, from Britain's far-flung imperial possessions.
So there's a coconut pudding over there, so perhaps a West Indian influence, and we didn't have the Indian biscuits before, but yeah, apart from that, not a great deal. Mainly French and Italian influences.
Yeah, we were expecting to see more, I think, from the colonies, and yeah, wasn't as in abundance as we thought it would be, so that was quite surprising to us, I think.
And finally, which of these recipes have you tried out yourselves so far?
We haven't tried any out yet, unfortunately, but I've got my eye on the transparent gingerbread.
I see.
Butter and treacle and sugar. And yeah, what about you?
I'd quite like to make the quaking pudding, actually, which I just love the name of it. It was named because of the way it sort of jiggled when they brought it out. So yeah. I thought, and the name's good. I like it. Yeah. So I hope to make that one.
Sounds delightful.
So that was Amy Croker and Zoe Harrigan of the Borthwick Institute at the University of York. And that's about all for this week's episode. We shall be back next week when we'll be discussing the Spanish Civil War, among other things. And in the meantime, as usual, keep an eye on our website, historyextra.com, where you'll find blogs, quizzes, galleries and more. And don't forget you can find us on social media, Facebook and Twitter, and you can find our Kindle and iPad editions on the Amazon website and Apple Newsstand respectively. The History Extra weekly podcast is recorded in Bristol and produced by Dave Gibson.